Now, the voices of Bronco Athletics, Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll hear from Boise State wide receiver Cedric Wilson. And we'll ask him if that catch he made in the scrimmage that hardly anyone saw was the best catch he's ever made. We'll get the answer when he comes on at 1:15. But first, NBA makes some history yesterday. First time two 25-point scorers are traded for one another. The gist of the trade was Kyrie Irving finally getting dealt to Boston in exchange for Thomas and a few others for the Celtics and the number one pick that the Nets will have that the Celtics now have given away to Cleveland. A lot going down. Chris, I'm trying to go back in my mind of when I think there has been a bigger blockbuster deal in sports in any league, and I don't know that I can see it. I've got a couple, but I'm not sure if they eclipse this.
Yeah, I want to hear it because I am trying to think, and the NBA really isn't an example of two teams who were conference title contenders basically trading their best and second best players and other pieces in there. I don't know. Even do you want to go to football? This usually doesn't happen. You want to go to baseball? This usually doesn't happen.
I've got one for baseball. 1990, the Padres and the Blue Jays made a trade. Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar went to Toronto and helped them get some World Series for Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez. You had four starters that swapped spots. Blue Jays got the better of that trade, but those guys were all marquee names at the time. The other trade that I would even put in that ballpark for baseball was two ace starting pitchers were traded for one another in 72 because they were both going to hold out. Rick Wise, 25 years old, coming off a 17-14 sub-3 ERA season for Steve Carlton, 20-9, 3.56 ERA. Both of those guys, 25 and 26. Those are the only trades that I could remember that even come close to this one.
Yeah, it's a big one. It really is. I want to hear you and Fish's opinion on the trade before, because I, with the NBA being one of the sports that I probably follow closer than a lot of people follow, I want to hear what the more casual to less than casual NBA person thinks of this move before I kind of give my thoughts.
You want it, Fish, first? You're going to give it to me? You want me to go first? First of all, I was shocked that two teams that were 1-2 in the Eastern Conference would trade with one another. I was more shocked at that than who was actually traded, that Thomas would go for Irving and the two teams would shuffle rosters considering they played each other to get to Golden State. I'm surprised that they each wouldn't be worried that they were bettering the other team. Normally when you make a trade, you look at a trade from your team's perspective. You're trying to get better. But if they're your rival, your competitor to get to the championship series, I'd be interested in whether I'm making them better or not. If I'm trading with somebody in the Western Conference, if I make them better in the trade, I really don't care because the only way I'm seeing them is in the finals. And if I've been able to get to the finals, then I'm happy. I think that Cleveland probably has a better chance of this thing working out for them because they've got more pieces. The Celtics have put all their eggs in the Kyrie Irving basket. I think Danny Ainge, when he looked at the end of last season and didn't get by Cleveland, thought he was never going to get by Cleveland and was never going to get by Golden State because he only has four players back from last year's team that won the Eastern Conference regular season. They were the top seed. Mm-hmm. He's kept Tatum, he's kept Brown, Horford, Smart. Those are the guys that are back.
Tatum wasn't there last year.
Wasn't there. It was Rozier that was there, right? So Tatum is a guy you add through the draft, not through trade. You pick up Hayward. This Celtics team is going to look totally different. I think it's that Ainge thinks that he couldn't beat them with what he had, so he's blowing it up. He's starting over with the pieces he wants. And I think from Cleveland's perspective, they knew that Irving wasn't going to be happy. They tried to get the best deal they could and shockingly got it from Boston.
Five of the top seven scorers from last year's Celtics team aren't on the team this year, which is crazy for a team that was the number one seed in the East. All right, Fish, what you got?
Well, I think this goes a long way into saying that what a lot of people talked about. We mocked my Pelicans for it. We signed Jrue Holiday to a max extension. He's not worth it. Why would you do that? Because they got stuck. Boston was about to be stuck signing a 5'9 guard, using that height loosely, to a max deal. There was people who said you can't do that, but he'd endeared himself to Boston, especially with the playoff run with his sister tragically passing away. They're going to basically be forced into signing Isaiah Thomas to a max deal, which makes me think the Celtics really didn't want to do that. Obviously, Crowder and Zizek, they had to throw in to make the salary cap match up, but I think it was probably more known in inner NBA circles. The Celtics want to get rid of this guy because the Cavs, they can just let him go. He has no ties to Cleveland. So I think this proves Boston didn't want to sign Isaiah Thomas to a max deal, and they wanted to get rid of him more than the Cavs wanted to get rid of Kyrie. So that's why they said, all right, take the first round, pick the next pick. We just want to get rid of Isaiah because we don't want to have $30 million for the next 5 years on our books for a guy who's 5'8".
So you're saying this makes sense for the future, although you're giving away maybe your most valuable future asset in that Brooklyn pick.
Yes, because you're not locked up with a 5'9 guy for
$30 million.
You don't
have to sign him.
You have to.
They don't have a gun in your head pointing you to sign Isaiah Thomas. So, all right, here's where I'm going to go. Boston would have been better off for next season not trading with Cleveland. They would have had a better chance to make the NBA Finals by not trading with the Cavaliers. Everybody's saying, oh, now that Boston's got Kyrie Irving, that are they now, is that the next step for them to become the title contender from the Eastern Conference? And what they did was they made Cleveland better for next year. Say what you want about Kyrie Irving. Isaiah Thomas last year was just as good as Kyrie. In fact, he averaged more points per game. He was more efficient. He was second-team All-NBA. Kyrie wasn't second-team All-NBA last year. That was Isaiah Thomas. Now, you could say, well, you know, Kyrie's style of play is more sustainable. But just for next year, even if you want to say Kyrie Irving is better, it's slight. It's not much better. And then you're throwing in Jay Crowder, who's, I know, not the biggest attractive name for a lot of non-NBA fans, but you want to think of like a starting caliber player. I mean, I wouldn't call him like a Chandler Hutchison, like at the college level with Boise State, but he's somebody of that build who could defend a lot of different positions, who's a really good shooter, and he's on a 3-year deal for $22 million. If he was a free agent this offseason, he probably would have made $20 million. Goes to show you what big of a deal, what kind of a deal of a contract that he is for the Cavaliers. That was their biggest weakness against Golden State. They have enough wing players to defend the Kevin Durants and the Draymond Greens on the other side. They got that in Jay Crowder. Along with Isaiah Thomas, who's a pretty good replacement for Kyrie Irving, Cleveland got better for next year. Boston is farther from Cleveland than they would have been if they didn't make the trade and forcing Kyrie to be traded to a different team, not getting as much back. That's why I don't understand it from Boston's perspective from next year. And then if you want to say, all right, future angle with this, well, they just gave up their most valuable future piece in that Brooklyn pick, which Brooklyn's terrible, y'all. Like, Brooklyn's awful. They'll probably will be a top five worst team in the NBA next year, and that pick would have been top five. And now they just gave that up to get rid of Isaiah and to just try to not sign him from Fish's logic. I don't understand it from Boston. I really don't. They got Kyrie. Everybody's kind of celebrating. But is this helping you now? Is this helping you in the future? Where is Boston winning from this deal?
I wonder if this could be one of those trades that ends up hurting both teams. You change chemistry, you change people. Is it possible that both teams will end up being weaker because of this trade?
I think Cleveland's better. You got a wing player who can defend Kevin Durant. Like, you didn't have one of those. You got a pick that's going to be top five, and if you don't think that you want to select somebody in the top five, you could probably trade that pick for somebody near the deadline. So I don't see how Cleveland gets worse. Like, they were in a position where earlier this offseason, you had Paul George traded for a bag of basketballs, basically. You had Jimmy Butler traded for a bag of basketballs plus a whistle for a practice to help out. And Kyrie Irving, who it was public that he demanded a trade, so you would think that Cleveland would have less leverage than those other teams. They got pretty much a ransom for a star, which you never see in the NBA, of getting pretty much equal value. So, yeah, I don't see how Cleveland loses this. And if you're Boston, you're just upset that this offseason, as I mentioned, Paul George was traded for nothing. Jimmy Butler was basically traded for nothing. And you gave up all that for Kyrie. If you could rewind this offseason, try to acquire Jimmy Butler, draft Markelle Fultz for your point guard of the future, sign Gordon Hayward, and you're better set up for now and the long term than you are right now. So I think it's a failure of an offseason for Boston. They messed this up.
We shall see. A lot went to Cleveland. I thought more than they would have had to give up. I wonder who they were really bidding against and what was really on the table for Irving.
Sounds like not much, because they wanted to trade him to the West, to your point. Like, they didn't want to trade him to Boston. You don't want to trade with your conference rival, but apparently nobody in the West stepped up to the plate, and the best offer was clearly from the Celtics. If I'm Cleveland, and they have a new GM who just got there, it's sad to see Dan Gilbert happy about something. Like, he has to be happy about this, which, you know, he's probably the least likable figure in basketball. And their new GM, shout out to him, who gets a pretty good deal on his first major move made.
Do you think LeBron is happy with this deal? I would think he should be, but is he?
I think he would be, right? The team's still competitive for a championship next year, and he's probably off to L.A. anyway, right? Like, I still don't think he's going to sign up long-term with Cleveland after this season because everybody's sure he's going to L.A., so that probably doesn't change anything, but he has a good chance to win the title this year, so good for him.
Again, first time, two 25-point scorers from a season before were traded for each other in the offseason, so quite history made yesterday in the NBA. All right, right now, be ready to go. Call 208-424-9300. Be the third caller, and you'll win a gift card from Beef O'Brady's. Get to Beef's on northwest corner of Overland and Eagle to score lunch or dinner. Beef's is great for business lunches, sports watch parties, or get-togethers with family and friends. They have an award-winning menu and a huge video wall with a ton of big-screen TVs. Beef O'Brady's in Meridian, good food and good sports. When we come back, Cedric Wilson had a breakout year in 2016. What are his plans for 17, and was that scrimmage catch really the best ever? Next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Welcome back to Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris. We're here from 1 to 3. Caves and Prater will bring you home from 3 to 6. Last season, Boise State got a junior college transfer that really exploded on the scene. Cedric Wilson, in his junior season, had 56 catches for over 1,100 yards, 11 touchdowns, averaging 20 yards a catch. He was voted one of the three captains coming into the season, along with Brett Rippon and Leighton Vander Esch. He joins us now to talk Boise State football. Cedric, first of all, congratulations on being named captain. How does it feel?
It's a pretty good honor to know that the guys would select me to be the captain for this year's team. Really never thought about it until we had to do the voting in the team meeting. And when Tarson told me, I was pretty excited.
So getting to be a captain, also getting to be on a banner outside the stadium. Like, how odd is it just seeing your picture out in front on campus where everybody else can take a look at you?
It's kind of surreal, actually, but it's just another honor to go outside there and represent the entire university, since the whole city of Boise gets to see it. But just honored that the team and the coaches would pick me to go outside there along with other seniors.
Do you think it's a good picture of you? Would you have liked to do it again? Do you like it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. Pretty good side shot.
So, Cedric, when you decided to come here to Boise State, 56 catches last year, over 1,000 yards, 11 touchdowns, voted captain. What were you expecting when you signed up to come here? This? More than this? Not as much as this?
I think, well, most of my goals were reached pretty much like individual-wise, but I didn't really think much coming here. I just knew that I was blessed with the opportunity to come play Division I football, and if I did what the coach just taught me to do and what I practiced, all the accolades would come. So it's pretty much just an end-of-the-season review that I get to look over and now critique it.
Cedric Wilson joining us here on Idaho Sports Talk, Boise State receiver. And Bob read off some of the stats, and we've seen the production. My question is, what do you think some of the people around the conference are holding against you? Because you weren't named to the All-Mountain West teams, your honorable mention last season. In the preseason, I would think you were a lock to be preseason first team, and somehow they left you off the list.
I'm not really sure. I don't really look into all that. I'm just focusing on winning some games. That's pretty much what we're trying to do. Rankings really don't mean anything player-wise, as long as your team's winning.
So what do you want to be better at this year? I mean, statistics, sometimes you can have better statistics and not have a better year and vice versa. But what are you looking at? When you looked at yourself last year and you said, for me to be a better receiver, I need to do X, Y, and Z, what would that be?
I think I just need to – well, Coach Keys tells me all the time that I just need to focus on my like the details of my route running and just work on being more physical in the run game. So those two things, I think, will be emphasis this year.
How will things be different for you this year with no Thomas Spurbeck on the other side?
I mean, I think it will be pretty much the same. We have a few key guys filling in that I think could help offense just as much as he did.
We're visiting with Cedric Wilson, senior receiver, one of the captains on this year's Boise State team. Bob Beeler, Chris Lewis here on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Cedric, what about some of those other receivers? Who have you seen in this camp that has really kind of emerged and improved?
Well, the three guys that stand out right off the bat are Sean Monster, Akeelian Butler, and A.J. Richardson. Those are just three of the guys that didn't get to play much last year, but are also upperclassmen in the receiver room.
So how do you think those guys have gotten better? As you're watching them maybe on film more than actually at practice, where are the areas that they've taken the strides?
I mean, each one of them are different types of receivers. So Sean Moss is a really good route runner. AJ has really good hands. And then Akeelian brings a lot of quickness to the receiver core. So I think everybody just together is pretty much like a dominating force in the receiver room.
How about some of the, you mentioned the upperclassmen. Have you seen anything out of some of the newcomers that could lead to success down the line for them?
Yeah, we have a few talented freshmen that came in. Cottrell Thomas and Octavius Evans are two key freshmen that came in. Cottrell is a guy like Julian, and then Octavius is like nobody else in the receiver room. He's big, and he can move.
Well, you're big, and you can move also. Brett Rippon found you a lot of times last year, 56 times. Let's talk about Brett. You work with him every single day. Where do you think he's going to be better this year?
I think he's just getting older, and with that comes more wisdom. So I think he's learned the offense more, and then he also sometimes knows the offense too much. But I think he's just improving his game. He always works at it, and I think that will help him a lot.
We're joined by Cedric Wilson, Boise State receiver here on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio, The Ticket. And one of the things when I look at the Boise State offense this year, I feel like the tight ends will have a lot more production this year than last year. Just because injuries, Jake Rowe was in and out of the lineup last year. How do you think the healthy tight end room could help the receiving core in the passing game as a whole?
I think they're going to help a lot because not only they can make blocks, but most of our tight ends can also catch and run routes. So they'll be a big part, and then they're probably the most experienced room off the whole team since they have, I think, three seniors. So I think that'll be a big part of the offense this year.
Cedric, we're a little more than a week away from the start of the season. You don't get any preseason games in college. Is there anything that you guys really want to work on between now and then that you think really needs to kind of get sharpened up before the first real game?
No, I think just keep listening to the coaches, and they'll get us prepared for the game. Just make sure everybody's healthy and ready to go.
Now, speaking of lead up to the season, the first fall scrimmage that the team had, Coach Harsin came out of that just raving about a catch that you apparently made where it was the best catch he's ever seen. You jumped over a three-story building and your arm stretched out like Michael Jordan in Space Jam and you were able to hold on. I mean, it was seeming like it was hyped up that much. How do you describe that catch you made in that fall scrimmage that got everybody talking?
I mean, I think it was a pretty good catch when I watched it on film, but I think it just came from like preparation and like just working on hand-eye coordination a lot. And then like coach says, whatever you practice is going to become game reality. And it just went out there and just went up for the ball.
When you make a catch like that, like, do you know it's a crazy catch or do you have to like watch it back and like see it on film and be like, oh my goodness, I did that?
Yeah, well, I have to, like, go look at the detail of it. I know I caught it with, like, one hand, but I didn't really know, like, what it looked like, so I just had to go back and watch it.
So would you judge it a better catch than any catch you had last season?
Yeah, it was definitely better than the catch that I had during the season because I don't think I wrote in any one-handers last year.
Cedric, thanks for your time. We hope you don't have to make a lot of one-handers this year, that you're wide open all the time and Brett just throws it right in there.
Speaking for yourself, I want to see some one-handed catches. I don't know about you. I love those. Those are awesome.
Yeah, that's the plan.
All right, Cedric, thanks for your time. We really appreciate it. Good luck this year.
All right, thank you. Take care.
And you know, last year, Chris, you and I were in the booth together for his debut game at Louisiana, three touchdowns, and I think better than 100 yards. As we look at Wilson, one of the few people, I'd say, when they come in, especially from junior college, that exceeded what you thought, at least what I thought he'd be capable of doing. I think he's been a godsend to the program.
Yeah, they warned us, though. Coaches warned us. They said that, you know, in the preseason, yeah, this guy is pretty good. So be on the lookout for him. And from the first game on, he did it. I'm just upset with you trying to tell him not to do one-handed catches.
No, I mean, it'd be easy if you don't have to, right? If your wide's wide open and,
okay,
and there's nobody within 5 yards of you, that would be great,
wouldn't
it? What's
a better call for a play-by-play
guy? A better call would be a nice play.
Cedric Wilson's wide open, makes the catch
for a
touchdown.
But we're going to win a lot more games if everybody's wide open.
Or Cedric Wilson over the top of the defensive back and makes a one-handed behind-the-head catch and brings it in for a touchdown. That would be more fun.
That would be more fun to see. But you're going to win more games if your guys are always wide open.
All right, I'll listen to your argument a little bit. Part of the reason I watch football is for these one-handed catches, though.
And he's fun. He's fun to watch. I hope that the other receivers are able to play near his level of football, because if they are, it's going to force the defenses to be honest, which was what I think last year with Spurbeck and him. You really couldn't double them both. And I think this year that, you know, he hasn't made much of it. When we've asked him, and other people have asked him about, you know, seeing the brunt of the other team's defense, he's going to see the brunt of the other team's defense. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and I also would have to think that with Boise State and their style, with the shifts and the motions, like, I had to have a feeling that the coaching staffs will make it difficult for opposing teams to double Cedric Wilson anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they'll do things with movement before the play to make it really, or else they're going to be really exposed defensively, and you can do schematic things to free up the other receiver. So I don't even think it really matters on the other side. I think the coaches will do a good enough job of scheming them open.
You can listen to The Ticket on your way to and from Broncos Fan Appreciation Day at Albertson Stadium on Saturday. Mike Prater, Chris Lewis, and I will be previewing and reviewing the Broncos' final scrimmage before the home opener on September the 2nd against Troy. We'll have interviews and analysis beginning at 1 on Saturday, and then again right after the scrimmage is over for your ride home. It's all on your FM home for Boise State Football, Sports Radio 93.1 FM, The Ticket. Fish, we got an update coming up. What's in it?
Well, big payday for a former Boise State offensive lineman, plus a guy whose head coach said he should stay a year in college. Looks like he's poised to be the week one starter in the NFL. That's up next on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
The Ticket Sports Update.
The Sports Update is sponsored by Idaho Foot and Ankle Associates in Boise, Meridian, and Nampa. They measure success 1 foot at a time. Another way to measure success, how much money you're getting paid to do what you do. Charles Leno, quite successful today. Leno, a former Boise State offensive lineman, and the Bears have agreed to a 4-year extension worth $38 million, $21.5 million guaranteed. Leno was in the final year of his rookie deal heading into this year and had been the permanent starter on the Bears offensive line since week 4 of 2015.
Boise State's had some linemen that have gone on to a lot of success in the NFL. Clady, College, Paradis, Odhiambo was hopefully heading in that direction. Offensive line's probably been the best position coming out of here.
Will you put the pressure on Ezra Cleveland to be the next guy?
Remember I said I was the guy, I guess. Why not? I'm going to the position that's hot, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So see that contract, and maybe there's another one along the line.
I also like 6'6", 300 or whatever he is, too.
Yeah, he's a big dude. Now, Leno, I guess congratulations on that. You got to protect Trubisky, so make sure he's all healthy and ready to go. Although, at the start of the year, I don't know if it'll be Trubisky there.
Well, speaking of rookie quarterbacks, at the start of year for the Cleveland Browns, we don't know if it's going to be Brock Osweiler anymore. The Browns have announced that rookie DeShone Kizer is going to get the start in their Week 3 preseason game, and that Brock Osweiler is not even going to play in the game. Osweiler started the first two games, and now ESPN's reporting that the Browns have attempted to trade Osweiler. However, offers are very limited due to his $16 million salary. The team has not announced Week 1 starter yet, but it looks like it might be given over to DeShone Kizer, who, if you're Brian Kelly, wishes he was still in college.
Well, I was going to say, I watched him the other night when he had his helmet off, shaking hands. He looks young. Kizer does. But it looks like they're going to try to follow in the Tampa Bay idea of give the keys to the young guy that you think might be your starter down the line and let him go, as opposed to going in the Jacksonville game plan that, Chris, that you alluded to last week, where you're always monkeying around with who's starting quarterback.
Yeah, it's empowering the youth, although I have a feeling this won't work out too well because Cleveland's going to be bad. I think they're going to fire Hugh Jackson at the end of the year. They're probably going to bring in a new coordinator, and then it's just going to be a disaster of ruining a quarterback and before he even has a chance to succeed. But I don't know, maybe he'll turn it around. But I think the story here is Brock Osweiler. Brock Osweiler, Mr. I've never done anything wrong in my life. I deserve to have everything, even though I've never proven anything. Another setback for him. Maybe he'll look in the mirror one of these times instead of blaming some other people like he always does.
So he's played for three organizations now. I mean, he's been in exhibition games. The Broncos, the Texans, the Browns. Is this a game of, like, hot potato where you try to get rid of it and we'll see how many teams can have Brock Osweiler before his career's done?
I mean, he's perfect for a backup quarterback, right? He's just going to be around and be tall. So you can see him holding up the signs on the sidelines and the clipboard and whatever you need him to do. He's tall enough where you can see him down there. I heard somebody say he's too tall. I think it was Herman Edwards who said he's too tall. The quarterbacks apparently can be too tall to be effective because they have just too long of motions to throw and everything they do is way too drawn out, and you'd rather have your guy at the quarterback spot a little bit more compact. Maybe there is something to that, and that also explains, maybe it was about Paxton Lynch too. Like, Paxton Lynch too tall to be effective. Brock Osweiler is about that height, so maybe you don't want your quarterback to be 6'7".
The only problem with your perfect backup plan there, Chris, that's $16 million salary.
Yeah,
that kind of hurts.
They might want to trade that. Although the Browns, the whole point of them acquiring that is they also got a pick to acquire Brock Osweiler. It was like an NBA trade, yep, where you're using your salary cap to get a future asset. Brock Osweiler only has one year left on this. They could sever ties after this season, so he's around. It's not like Cleveland's doing anything else with that salary cap money.
Just getting to the floor. That's all they need to do. Well, speaking of football players, apparently all it took to figure out when Le'Veon Bell is coming back was a Twitter fan asking about his status so that they would know for fantasy football. Bell responded to the status saying, quote, 9-1-17, then saying you're welcome, assuming that's his return date. He would come back one day after the Steelers' fourth preseason game and then have 9 days to get ready for their week one matchup against the Browns.
It's always something, though, with Le'Veon Bell at the start of the year, whether he was, like, in a car smoking weed with, with Le'Veon Bell, or with
LeGarrette
Blount
Williams.
Before, it was LeGarrette Blount.
Oh, yeah, LeGarrette Blount, yeah.
Before the preseason game when they're on a team plane, or whether it's being suspended another time at the beginning of the year. He always has something going on at the start of
like
the season.
Doesn't like week one. Not a big week one fan.
Week one is not his favorite. Yeah, he's supposed to be there by week one this time, but will he be ready to go? Missing training camp.
I'm sure that if he does, other people, if he does well, are going to say, hey, I don't need to be there.
That's true. I think somewhere NFL teams are like rooting against his success. If he comes out the gate and like tears it up week one, it's like, oh, does anybody need training camp?
They're really rooting for like a pulled groin that's going to make him miss like just 2 weeks. Just so they can tell everyone, you got to come to these preseason games. You're going to pull a groin. Well, Chris, you celebrate today. Your Phillies dropped another 2 games last night to the Marlins.
You don't need to be losing to the Marlins like this.
Well, that's what happened, and it was a perfect epitome for baseball this year as the two teams combined to hit 14 home runs in their doubleheader. That would be the second most in baseball history, and that even included a 3-run home run from Ichiro himself. That's it. There's something wrong with the balls of Ichiro's hitting 3-run home runs in doubleheaders.
Who was the home team?
It was the Phillies.
That's a bandbox. I've always thought that the foot mark, you know, however many feet it is to the outfield, I think has been fake. It was fake originally, mm-hmm, left center especially. So that's a bandbox. That's a homer dome.
So is Bob out here on his political game saying fake news? The numbers on the walls at Citizens Bank Park are fake news?
Yeah, I guess so. I've always thought it, or it certainly seems like it plays shorter than it is. You've been to Citizens Bank.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the biggest ballpark in the world. Ichiro, though, I still think if he, in an alternate career, Ichiro could have been a 30 home run a year guy.
We'll never know. We do know one thing, though. The Marlins back at 500 for the first time since April. 5.5 games out of the wild card. You better watch out, Dodgers. Speaking of home runs, Albert Pujols made some home run history yesterday. He broke his tie with Sammy Sosa and now is the career home run leader for home runs hit by a non-U.S. born player. He moves into eighth all time with 610 home runs, and he is two behind Jim Thome for seventh.
You can win a table for four at Dave & Buster's to watch the Mayweather-McGregor fight. Register at KTIK.com right now for you and three buddies to watch the fight in style, complete with appetizers and beverages. Hit KTIK.com to win a VIP table for the fight right now. Quick Hits, where Chris and I will tackle four topics in rapid-fire fashion, is next, including who would you pick with a second pick in fantasy football draft, and what's the dumbest thing I've heard in a long, long time. That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris. Topic number one.
All right, Chris, why do you feel ESPN is being wrongly criticized?
This has become a story that Robert Leaves, the play-by-play announcer with ESPN, he was pulled off the first game of the year when he was doing the game in Charlottesville. You know, kind of a hot topic with statues being removed and everything like that. And I feel like the criticism's coming because, oh, they're too PC, they're taking the eye off a game. And from what I understand, I think this is part like Robert Lee not wanting to become like a half story of the game by like basically having to tell a story about Robert Lee when your name is Robert Lee. In the middle of a broadcast about Virginia football. So, like, I do think this was done to kind of protect him in a way, and I think he was on board with wanting to, all right, we can find another game for me, right? Like, we don't have to do this Virginia game. There's just so much nonsense going around it. So can I do a different game in week number one? And ESPN's like, yeah, that makes sense. Let's have you do a different game in week number one. But instead, they're just being ripped for being too PC and taking away an opportunity. They're not taking away an opportunity from him. He's still getting a chance to do a game, and he'll still have his normal amount of games this year. I think this was an instance of them not really being able to keep a secret very well and kind of being reactionary for, you know, the fact that, yeah, you kind of got caught by the Clay Travises of the world just blowing this up into something that's a monster big deal, and now you feel like you're being reactionary. But in itself, I don't mind the decision. Like, if there was a story about some, you know, Chris Lewis who was in the news for a bad reason, calling a game week number one in Eugene, Oregon, for example, and if there was an opportunity for me to be able to get a game somewhere else where that whole thing isn't a story, I would like the opportunity to call a different game than the one in Eugene, Oregon.
I'm surprised that people even knew a couple weeks before the game who was going to call an internet game. It's an ESPN3 game, not an ESPN game. And it's not like you're giving up a game. You know, William & Mary, Virginia, is that an A game? No. Is Youngstown State against Pitt an A game? No. So he's still doing a game. I think that I don't know who requested or who brought it up first. Might have been ESPN, might have been Robert Lee. Robert does a good job. I've known him since he was the radio voice at Siena, and I'm glad at least he's getting to do a game.
Topic number two.
What might Major League Baseball implement next season?
Well, they're talking about a universal fan code of conduct. Now, I'm wondering what might be in it, because I'm sure, first of all, each stadium probably has its own rules. Certainly the, you know, rules that the police would get you for, like being intoxicated or running out on the field. But I think maybe this is going to be more things that fans are allowed to say at the game, with profanity or racist comments, because other things, I think, are taken more by the police in the sense that, you know, you can't go on the field, you can't throw things at people, you can't be drunk. I'll be interested to see what they come out. The commissioner makes it sound like he's coming out with something in September. And do they really need it? Are the rules that are in there anything that wouldn't really already be enforced at a park right now?
Is this in reaction to the Boston-Baltimore?
It sounds like maybe it is, with the fans that said things to Adam Jones. And that's about the only thing I can think of, is going in the nature of heckling or saying, as I said, profanity or racist comments at people. I would think most everything else would already be handled through, you know, means of, you know, if you're drunk, they'll arrest you. If you're on the field, they'll arrest you. I don't know what else they could be going for.
Topic number three.
All right, Chris, if you had the second pick in a fantasy football draft, who would you choose?
This is getting tougher than it was, let's say, a couple of weeks ago, because usually the conversation and the number one pick was either David Johnson or Le'Veon Bell. But I feel like a lot of people now, you're souring on Le'Veon Bell because he's missed all the preseason. He won't report until September 1st. No training camp. There is a track record of players who've been very productive. Then they got to the point where they held out. And then that season when they held out, their production dropped. I think Matthew Berry of ESPN said something like it's 27% statistical drop-off in your holdout season than the 3 years before. So that's pretty significant reason why you wouldn't take Le'Veon Bell number one, and maybe not even number two. So then it's like, all right, Odell Beckham might come up in the conversation for a guy you'd pick number two. But it looks like he might miss either 1 to 2 weeks. That's what Dan Graziano of ESPN reported, that Odell Beckham is no certain to start the season for the Giants. So, given that Le'Veon Bell is a question mark, given that Odell Beckham has a question mark, I would make the case that Antonio Brown is who you should pick with the number two pick in fantasy football drafts this year. Even though You know, he might be on the backside of his career. He's getting to that age of 30. We've probably seen the best of Antonio Brown, and Martavis Bryant might be coming back. I feel like he's the most reliable guy, and it's crazy to say receiver with the number two overall pick. Fantasy football, usually so running back heavy. But yeah, right behind David Johnson, I would go with Antonio Brown.
Where would Ezekiel Elliott be listed if he weren't going to miss, at least as of now, the first six games of the season? There's another guy that you might want to have in there.
That's a good point. He was also in that conversation for top three, right with David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell, so you add him to the list of him missing six games. It is, oddly enough, a very volatile year for fantasy football, consensus top draft picks.
Now, yesterday when we were talking about the players that in the NFL that really make things sizzle, the running backs, I said, I think is the reason why I think there are fewer of those players around now, because that position is not what it once was as far as statistics, use, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But in fantasy football, it seems like the running back position is at the biggest premium. Is it because the way the stats are rated, or is it just that there's just a handful of guys out there that can put those numbers up? Because everybody you're giving me is somebody you want to have in the first pick, second pick, third pick. Mm-hmm. They're all running backs, and I don't think anybody would advocate that if you were really, truly making a draft back in April.
Yeah, that's true, and a lot of it is because the premium aspect, right? Like, back in the day, it was because they scored the most. Like, LaDainian Tomlinson and, you know, back in the day, Tiki Barber. Like, those guys would score a lot, and you needed two of those. But, like, in 2017, it's just a drop-off hit. I'm reading you on the ESPN list the top running backs, and there really isn't that many, like, attractive runners in here. But David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, LaShawn McCoy. Then you get to Melvin Gordon, which, all right, you're talking about a one-year track record where he was halfway good. Devontae Freeman, Jordan Howard, Leonard Fournette, Jay Ajayi, DeMarco Murray, Todd Gurley, Lamar Miller. Like, you're getting to guys who either have question marks about their sustainability or they're in a dual backfield. So if you could get a bona fide lead back, you have to take that early in the draft.
Topic number four.
All right, I was waiting all day for this quick hit. What is the dumbest thing you've heard in a while? Bob calling something or somebody dumb.
Well, ESPN has this ranking where they rank all of FBS football 1 to 128 in the happiness rankings for the fan bases. Boise State was ranked 17th. Idaho was next to last at 127. But what intrigues me are some of them in between, and I just don't know how they're coming up with it. I think they're just pulling names out of a hat for the most part. I got a couple of them. Top of the list, Washington. I can understand why you're happy. You're number 11. You might be happier than that, but I can say you're certainly one of the most happy fan bases. What does USC have this year coming back? A lot, right? They're ranked 31. Can you tell me that UCLA, Oregon, and Baylor should be happier about their football program than USC? No way. No way. And how about these two, back-to-back in the middle of the list, 81 and 82, Air Force and Cal. Air Force has had winning seasons, gone to three straight bowl games. They won 10 games last year. They've won 10 games two of the last 3 years. Cal's last 10-win season is back to 06. They've changed coaches. They've got debt issues with the stadium. There's no way that Cal's fan base is close to being as happy with their football program as Air Force. But how about this one? Maybe this is the one that gets it for me the most. Temple, way towards the bottom. They're at 118. They have back-to-back 10-win seasons at Temple. If anybody's ever been there, I would have thought they'd drop football before they'd ever be good. They had no winning seasons from 91 to 08. They were kicked out of the Big East after the 04 season. Temple fans have to be about as happy as they can be at 118. Unbelievable. ESPN, you're just picking names out of a hat.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris on 93.1 The Ticket.
I didn't want to say anything after that because I couldn't top it. I couldn't add to it. That was fantastic. Well done, Bob. That was a great rant. There you go. I'm with you, though, Temple.
I mean,
I'm from Philly, man. Like, right. Temple football is so irrelevant. Like, if you rooted for Temple football, you are the happiest person right now, because they're actually worth watching. They're actually decent. Like, you've waited your whole life for this.
Right. If you're a Temple fan, you would have to say back-to-back 10-win seasons, wake me up when the dream is over, because there's no way anybody could ever have projected that.
Yeah, that is nuts. I don't know how. Just too much happy. I feel like they're listening to that Pharrell song, Happy, and maybe that's how they measured it, because that's the only thing that makes sense. How many times were you playing that Pharrell song over and over and over again?
I don't know. Interesting list. Again, I'm sure anytime you come up with a list, there's things that you're going to question, but this one just didn't seem very well researched at all. Have the first Coach Harsin Weekly tonight at 7 right here on Sports Radio The Ticket, your FM home for Boise State football. In addition to Coach Harsin, we'll hear from all the captains, Brett Rypien, Cedric Wilson, and Leighton Vander Esch. We heard from Cedric at 1:15 today. You can hear that podcast a little bit later when they get it up. I think Wilson's going to be a major factor in why this offense is going to move down the field and get into the end zone this year.
I mean, so much for saving the best for last. They just gave you all the captains right out the gate.
Yeah.
So you're starting heavy, I guess only downhill from there?
Probably so. The common denominators will be Coach Harsin and myself the rest of the way. But you're right. Rypien, Wilson, Vander Esch. That's A-list material tonight at 7. When we come back, more on the biggest trade ever in the NBA next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Yesterday, looking at Twitter, all of a sudden the big trade comes down, and the Celtics and Cavaliers, the top two teams in the NBA Eastern Conference, make a major trade, first time in the history of the league, 2 25-point-a-game scorers traded for each other. And joining Bob and Chris here on Idaho Sports Talk is Eric Pincus, who covers the NBA for Basketball Insiders. Eric, thanks for joining us. And how big actually was this trade? I mean, where do you rank it in the history of trades in the league?
Wow, that's sort of an overarching question. That's a little too broad to say in all of NBA history, but this is a pretty big deal. And what's nice for the Cavaliers is that they get some future assets. This is a team that could very well lose LeBron James after a year. And Kyrie Irving was demanding a trade, and even if he wasn't, he has one more year after LeBron, but probably gone too. Now you get Isaiah Thomas, who is equivalent. Maybe not the same, maybe not as good, depends on your point of view, but one of the best scoring guards at the point in the entire league. And then they also get Jay Crowder, who's a really nice player, a guy who can help them against the Warriors in the finals. I don't know if he's the reason why they win. And then you get the Brooklyn Nets pick. I mean, that's a nice pick. That could be a top, I don't know, five, top six, maybe number one pick in a really nice draft next year. And the kid Zizic, a big kid, a center could help them, you know, down the road, prospect, but nice there. But for the Celtics, I mean, Isaiah Thomas was a guy they were going to have to pay after this season. And he's, you know, 28-ish. He's very small, right? He's 5'9". Dealing with a hip issue, maybe they weren't comfortable giving him a max contract and going with a guy who's about 4 or so, 5 years younger and Kyrie Irving. They were willing to give up those assets to make that happen. I like it for both teams. I think the it's a little bit more of a reach in the sense of the Celtics gave up a little bit more, but I thought both teams did what they needed to do, and I would grade both teams as winners here.
See, that's where I can't get on board with you, with all due respect, just because how can both teams win a trade when they're 1-2 in the East, competing basically against each other for a trip to the NBA Finals this year? If one team got more better than the other team, I know more better isn't the most proper form of English.
More better.
But you can't have both teams be winners here, can you?
Sure you can. I mean, this is a now situation for the Cavs. After now, meaning this year, I do think LeBron leaves. And so now you have pieces that you can build around. So let's say you get Michael Porter Jr., one of the top prospects. And now it's a win now for the Cavs because they've got pieces to rebuild and they're moving forward, and they can maybe Jay Crowder, someone they could retrade and maybe get some young considerations as well. So it's a trade that helps now and later. For the Celtics, it's about now, but now for them is a longer now. Okay. So the now for them is like a 5-6 year window where they let's say Kyrie Irving resigns. He's got another year after next. So 2 years he resigns. They've got the Cavs are no longer the Cavs anymore because LeBron's gone, and they've got Gordon Hayward, Al Horford, young players, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. They've got a nice core of both young guys and veterans. And so maybe the Celtics are number two this year. Maybe it doesn't result in 100% perfect for them for today. But when the Cavs are gone, they're the team that is best in the East.
So you would agree with me in saying that Boston, by doing this trade, made it more difficult for them to win the East this year than if they didn't do the trade?
I would say that you can argue that, but then it does open up some time for Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Maybe they're ready to fill that Jay Crowder role. Maybe they're better than it's not so black and white where you say absolutely, but you can definitely argue. It depends on also, what do you think of Kyrie Irving in relation to Isaiah Thomas? Is Kyrie better? If you think he's better, then they got the best player in the deal, and you can argue it. I would say that, yeah, the Cavs are my favorite to get out of the East again. The Celtics are number two after this year. I think Celtics are number one, and I think that's that's a price you're willing to pay if you're Danny Ainge.
Eric Pincus joining us from Basketball Insiders. We're talking about the big Cavs-Celtics trade from yesterday. My question is do you think Ainge and the Celtics rate Irving better than the Cavaliers do and maybe other teams in the league do?
I mean, it's situational, right? So you look at what Kyrie Irving is, but he's, for whatever reason, miserable and doesn't want to be in Cleveland. So the value of what he is as a player in Cleveland, miserable, is not what the value of what Kyrie Irving brings to the court anywhere else where he's not miserable. So, and then in the case of Isaiah Thomas, there's the hip injury. They know more about it than I do. It's not going to scuttle the trade, but it's hard to say how long term, what can you do with a 5'9" point guard? Maybe last year was the best that they could possibly have done. And in the case of, you know, the Cavaliers, maybe that's a limit too. But when you've got LeBron James, you're more likely to get away with something like that. Maybe the Celtics, they'd reach their potential. So it's not flat out black and white because it's situational to each team. I like Kyrie Irving a little bit better myself as a player, and he's younger, so you get more years out of him.
All right, as we kind of step back and look at Boston here, and then my one criticism for them would be their offseason as a whole. Now, clearly Jimmy Butler was available for a trade, so was Paul George. While focusing on Butler, because he, just like Kyrie, had 2 years left on his deal, and Boston, for whatever reason, could not execute or did not want to execute that trade. I contend that a better offseason for them would have been finding a way to get Jimmy Butler. They've signed Gordon Hayward, and drafting Markel Fultz. That way you have your guard of the future if you need that. Jimmy Butler, Isaiah Thomas, and Gordon Hayward give you a better chance to win the title this year. So I think if they had to redo their offseason, they probably should have attacked it differently than the way they did.
You can argue it. I mean, you can argue that Kyrie Irving is the best player out of all that. You could argue Jimmy Butler because he's a better defender, is a bit more of a two-way player. He is older than Kyrie. It's certainly an argument you can make. But I will say also, because I spoke to some of the people involved around after the trade deadline, and the basic vibe I got from the Celtics side of things is that while they viewed their pick that they were getting via swap with the Nets as the number one pick, which is what it ended up being, that the teams they spoke to were risk averse and were thinking that maybe it was going to be the fourth pick or maybe it was going to be the third pick. And they weren't sure that it was going to, it wasn't tangible. And it was harder to make a deal when there wasn't that concrete, you have the number one pick. And so of course, when they made a deal, they ended up swapping first and third with the Sixers. That's a lot easier to do when you know what the pick is. And so I agree that there were opportunities along the way, but at the same time, they got Gordon Hayward, and some of that flexibility goes away. And so maybe you don't get Gordon Hayward if you make that trade earlier. So it's more of you have Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving. Maybe you could have gotten, say, Jimmy Butler, and now you're still with Isaiah Thomas. And then now next year you have to pay Isaiah Thomas at least $100, $150 million. And maybe that long-term isn't the right move. So I'm not disagreeing entirely, but equally, I think it's more complex than that.
Eric, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it. And certainly a lot of food for thought with the big names going back and forth between Cleveland and Boston. You almost never see trades amongst teams battling for the conference title.
Yeah, it's been a fun summer. I look forward to this. Thanks for
Thank you.
Me.
And that's Eric Pincus of Basketball Insiders. And the NBA's offseason certainly has not been one that has been dull.
Yeah, it's been very noisy. A lot of the concepts there, reasonable minds, I guess, could disagree on some things. And yeah, I just think if Boston could redo this offseason, it would just, on paper, make a lot more sense. You want Isaiah, you want Jimmy Butler, you want Gordon Hayward, along with Al Horford for this year? Or do you want to have to get rid of Isaiah Thomas to bring in Kyrie? That's not that much of an upgrade.
I think the biggest thing in the Celtics basically are saying is they did not like the roster they had at the end of the season because they basically blew it up.
Yeah, they did.
There's four guys left from a team that won the number one seed in the East, lost in the finals to Cleveland, and what, did they lose in six? Or was it five?
Five.
So they must feel that they weren't close enough. We'll see if they make Cleveland any better. If you are near Boise State tomorrow between 3 and 6, stop by the Tailgate Sports Bar and see Caves and Prater do a live edition of Idaho Sports Talk. Eats, drinks, and IST tomorrow from 3 to 6 at the Tailgate near the entrance to Ann Morrison Park. We've had the Little League World Series on in our studio during our show for the last couple of weeks. How much Little League on TV is too much? We'll discuss that next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Welcome back to Idaho Sports Talk. Bob and Chris here from 1 to 3. Caves and Prater will take over from 3 until 6. They have today Craig Thompson scheduled for 4 o'clock to lead off the 4 o'clock hour, Commissioner of the Mountain West. So tune in for that. Craig Thompson will be joining them. Little League World Series has been going on, and I guess, Chris, we can go further back than that because I think ESPN now does every single regional game as well, and they've put permanent stadiums, or Little League has, permanent stadiums where these regionals are played so that they are more conducive to television. They used to move them around, and some of the stadiums really weren't very TV-friendly. But this has become big business for ESPN. You look at programming during the day especially, programs when you know they would normally be running either just regular shows or replays, and they've gone all in on Little League, and they've done it for about a month.
Yeah, I mean, just even look at the press release that ESPN sent out when describing their coverage. 10-plus commentators to contribute to the ESPN's Little League World Series game coverage. You have the analysts who do the Sunday Night Baseball, at least part of it, Jessica Mendoza, Aaron Boone. They'll call the Little League World Series and Classic, and the Classic, that was the 20th. So you know, that's at least a Major League game. But they have a laundry list of commentators. They have Baseball Tonight anchored outside of the Little League Stadium where they're playing these games. They're also building shoulder programming around it from the ESPN Films, a couple of documentaries. They have taken this to a whole different level than what it used to be, as you said, like when they just showed the championship game and maybe the series that was that, and that's about it. Like they have turned this into something that is significantly bigger, almost March Madness level coverage of the Little League World Series. It's one thing to have the discussion, should we put the Little Leaguers on TV when it's the championship? But I think it's almost time to revisit the discussion of, okay, you're building this kind of, you're basically building your August programming as a network based off of Little Leaguers. Is that still okay with you?
It's odd, but it's becoming more okay with me than it was if you'd asked me that question 5 years ago and even 10 years ago.
Why?
Because I think society is so used to seeing everything now. Things aren't that special when they're on because everything's either online, you can see things, you know, Twitter is covering things, Facebook is covering things. There isn't a lot that doesn't get seen by the public now. It just seems to be a different time and place. And I never thought I would say that because I would have thought, you know, going back 5, 10 years that I would have said, oh, way too much pressure to put on kids. You know, no, we don't need to be showing the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat for 10 to 12-year-olds. But I think they handle it better than the kids did 10 years ago and certainly better than they did in my generation.
But my question is, we don't follow these kids unless they're superstars after the Little League World Series, really.
I don't think unless, you know, Todd Frazier of the Yankees played in the Little League World Series, but I wouldn't have known that or remember that other than they use that as a tidbit when he's playing a game. No, I don't. I think people basically go into – they kind of get vanished until maybe they might show up in a major league draft. Maybe what would that be, another 6 years down the line?
Yeah, so I don't know what kind of effect the – exposure has on them. Like, do they get really big-headed and like arrogant? Do they, if they make a mistake, is that something that like sticks with them and it's hard for them to overcome? Like, we don't really do features, we don't do follow-ups unless you become Todd Frazier, unless you're Monet Davis and you're now a national phenomenon. But what about the guy who like the other day, and I know this wasn't the United States team, but was it the
I think it was Venezuela against Mexico, but I don't know which side gave up the hit and which side?
It was actually the Dominican Republic pitcher. They gave up the game-winning hit to Venezuela, who ended up moving on to face Mexico. And the pitcher from the Dominican Republic not only was on national TV with his face on the ground crying, it was a really cool moment when the Venezuela team went up to kind of pick him up and say, hey, it'll be okay. But you just can't count on that kind of sportsmanship. I mean, it's great that they had it there at that moment, but that's not something that you could expect every game. But not only that he had to go through that moment, but they put him on TV the next day for him to relive that moment and to talk about it in an interview format, because we keep building this thing up to be this huge. And again, these are 10 to 12-year-olds. I kind of have a problem with everybody making all this money when it's college athletes who are not getting the good shake of it, when you have the networks and CBS putting on the March Madness tournament. A lot of people are getting a lot of things out of this, and we're doing it to expose the competitive nature of kids. I could see why, again, one thing if it's the championship. It's another thing when we have baseball tonight with Carl Ravitch and Jessica Mendoza and Aaron Boone and everybody on a desk analyzing the game that a 10 and a 12-year-olds were playing in. You know, that's a little uncomfortable to me.
I think everybody has their line. I think if you're analyzing it, much like you would analyze the Yankees-Red Sox game, I don't know. To me, that is a bit much. The show of the games, it's going to get streamed somewhere, I would think. Somebody probably put it up on, not that it would be the same kind of production values, it'd be somebody's phone, but the games would get seen other places. People are wanting to see those games.
I mean, we're not watching 10 to 12-year-olds in any other sport, are we? Like, you say that this is something that will be seen, but like, where's your counter example of 10 to 12-year-olds? But we're not seeing 10 to 12-year-olds play AAU basketball.
No, I think part of it is because it is an international event. People are coming from all over the world, so I think that adds interest to the event, to the programming. I think that there's a romance of playing baseball as a kid. Maybe it's more for my generation than for yours, but I think it's something that a lot of people have done. You know, we had Gabe Sinacropi on, and again, if it's true, and I don't know why he would say it if it wasn't, but it sounds like the majority of the TV money funnels back to the different leagues that makes the cost to play about as realistic for parents to have to burden than many of the other sports. Travel baseball, when you get older, may be the ultimate money pit.
That's great. It's great to hear when, you know, a lot of money is used to support people being able to play. So you're okay with it, at a point at least. And it seems like you're okay with where it is now, because, again, you're saying, well, we do put our phone out and video record everything. These are 10 to 12-year-olds. What if it were 8 to 10-year-olds? Like, where's the sliding scale? Yeah. Like, where's the limit here?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, go the other way. Should high school stuff be on TV? It never used to be. Never used to be. ESPN now televises, like, a high school game at least once a week.
Yeah, I think that's fine, just because the recruiting angle and how we cover recruiting, and maybe that's
okay. But let's say some
kid's
a sophomore in high school and drops the punt that allows the other team to win the national champ. I don't know. Maybe there isn't a national champ. The state championship. I mean, is it as crushing for that kid as it is for somebody 10 years old?
You said, where's your line? I think the line is high school. Like, that's where I would draw it. When you get to high school and you're playing on the same team as somebody who the nation kind of really wants to see, like was Zion Williamson, and he's on TV, and he will be this year in high school. I kind of think that's okay, personally. When 10 to 12, we're getting to the sketchy area. 8 to 10, okay, now that's too much. Like, six-year-olds, like, where you have to draw it somewhere, right?
Well, I've always thought that high school sports is different than youth sports. And my reasoning is, in high school, you try out for the team. Not everybody makes it. For the most part, you're playing for keeps in high school. And you're generally speaking, I guess now there's more pay to play, but there didn't used to be pay to play. In these other events, Optimus football, et cetera, the idea is participation. Everybody's supposed to play. Everybody's supposed to get in. And I think that at high school, you're playing more seriously than you are when you're under high school age. So I kind of am arguing out of both sides of my mouth a little bit. But I think this generation of kids is much better equipped to handle the being on TV and letting everybody see them than they were before.
Okay, but that statement you just made, what are you basing that off of? You don't have kids.
Mm-mm.
Are you out here talking to a lot
of
kids?
No, it just seems like they come off more worldly now, I think. They have phones, they tweet things, they look at things, they know what's going on. I mean,
could you say that it might have the opposite effect, that now the exposure is so much there that the mistake they made will become a gif, and that gif will live on longer than they will? Like,
Very possible, I guess. There could be the opposite
end of it. Like, I don't – that's the one thing. We're not connected to the 10 to 12-year-olds of the United States in 2017 to really know how they handle it. And that's the thing. We don't follow up with features on the – normal kid, or even really follow up on the guys who make the mistakes and see how that affected their life 5 to 10 years later.
I mean, it's very possible that if somebody were to win a game with the home run, that as an 11 or 12-year-old, that could be the biggest thing somebody would ever do, which I would find disappointing for me, that if one of my greatest achievements would come that early. I hope my greatest achievement hasn't come yet.
Yeah, because it always is like, you know, oh, I would love to have been on TV when I was, you know, 10 to 12 years old and playing. And I guess there's something to that. But when you have that attitude, you're always thinking of your positive moments. Mm-hmm. You're not thinking of the biggest mistakes that you may or may not have made at that moment. And now when we're starting to build studio shows around those mistakes that you may or may not have made at the age of 11 years old. All right, it's one thing when it's the game itself and there's no social media to commentate on it, but now there's social media, now there's GIFs, now there's Carl Ravitch after the game where they're redoing the highlights and kind of breaking it down. These are 11-year-olds. So my line is probably at some point before this where I'm uncomfortable with this amount of coverage for people who are this young.
Well, there's coverage for high school football here on Sports Radio The Ticket. That's the Treasure Valley Prep Rally, and it's brought to you by Mount West Bank. It'll air tomorrow at 4:45 on IST with Caves and Prater. Each week, a high school football coach will discuss the game of the week with Caves and Prater, so don't miss it. Mountain West Bank, love where you bank. Fish, we got an update coming up next. What's going to be in it?
Well, nice payday for a former Boise State offensive lineman, plus Wade Mayweather putting his money where his mouth is. That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Ticket Sports Update, sponsored by Big Judd's. Get a free small order of hand-cut fries with two regular-priced burgers or chicken sandwiches at Big Judd's today only. Big Judd's on Overland near Eagle Road or in protest near Boise State. Well, Charles Leno can have quite a handful of Big Judd's burgers after today. Former Boise State offensive lineman has agreed to a four-year extension with the Bears worth $38 million, $21.5 million guaranteed. Leno was coming into the final year of his rookie deal and had been the permanent starter on the Bears' offensive line since week four of 2015.
Good for him with the payday. Got to protect the franchise and Trubisky. My question is, who will stay there longer, Trubisky or Leno? That's depending on what you think of Trubisky as a quarterback. Leno outlasts this
lineman. Always seem to last, don't they?
Yeah, they can stick around quite a bit. So what do you think of Trubisky? Will Trubisky be the last quarterback that Leno protects with Chicago? Or will it continue to be a revolving door?
Well, the big fight is this weekend between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor, and Floyd Mayweather might be looking to make some extra cash on the side. According to RJ Bell of Las Vegas Insiders, Bell tweeted out that Mayweather is seriously considering betting $5 million on himself to win the fight. That would turn into a nice $6.25 million should he win and follow through on his bet, and perhaps he could use that extra million to buy back a follow from Justin Bieber on Instagram. Huh.
Are you allowed to bet on the fight if you're in a fight?
That was a question. You must be able to, but my question is, I don't think you should, because you certainly aren't going to be allowed to bet against yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If I'm Conor McGregor, I'll go do that. I'll bet on Floyd. Get in there, probably going to lose. I'll make even more money.
You should be making the money from the fight. Like, it's the whole point of the promotion and all that stuff, is that that's how you're making the money. I didn't think you should be betting on the result of the fight if you're actually in it.
Yeah, I actually have more problem with that than anything we discussed in the Little League story.
Yeah,
betting on yourself.
That's a little sketchy to me, too.
Well, Mitchell Robinson, a top 10 recruit who had committed to Western Kentucky University before deciding to leave school last month, not expected to play basketball this year. He's going to focus on the 2018 draft. Yahoo Sports reported that originally he considered Kansas or University of New Orleans to transfer, but instead has opted to just spend the next 8 months training, get ready to play the draft. So you have a lottery pick who will have no basketball prior to being drafted.
His either godfather or uncle, somebody that was related to him, was an assistant coach at Western Kentucky and left. I wonder if that had anything to do with it. And maybe he is taking a page out of the Josh Allen book, feeling that maybe his stock is as high as it can be, and if he goes and plays at Western Kentucky, that stock may not be the same as it was right now.
My question is, why isn't he looking for a pro league to play in for a little bit? Whether it's
the same principle that maybe you go play in China or wherever it is and you don't do as well as they think you should, that they'd expect you to light it up, right? I mean, do they think the pro leagues in, say, China, I think in Europe they think are better than the NCAA, but some of them they don't.
Okay, my follow-up would be, how is he training? Like, is he going to hire an agent to help him train? Like, who's he training with? Does he have the money to hire an elite trainer to get you really ready for the draft? That's why you usually play, so you can have access to a lot of the things that are needed to, you know, become one of the top draft picks. But maybe he's like, I'm already set up, I know who my trainer is, and I'm all set and ready to go. But I still would think somebody would, if you have the opportunity to make money playing basketball, you would. If you don't have college as one of your options, then you would try to make money playing basketball.
Well, speaking of basketball, we all know about the trade that went down yesterday with Kyrie Irving heading over to the Celtics in exchange for Isaiah Thomas, Jay Crowder, and a draft pick from the Celtics. Well, it turns out that according to The Undefeated, that wasn't their first choice. The Cavaliers apparently called the Warriors to get their interest on a Klay Thompson for Kyrie Irving slop. That was nowhere close to happening, which would be the second time the Warriors decided to keep their all-star core intact as opposed to adding a new person, as earlier this offseason, Pacers tried to execute the exact same thing, Paul George for Klay Thompson.
The Warriors have won. Why do they need to make changes?
How many times is somebody going to call the Warriors expecting them to trade Klay Thompson and them say no? Cleveland already tried that with Kevin, or was it no, Minnesota tried it
Kevin
with
Love.
Kevin Love. Mm-hmm. Klay Thompson, they're like, nah, we're not doing that. Paul George, nah, we're not doing that. Kyrie, nah, we're not doing that. Might starting to get the message that the Warriors aren't looking to trade Klay Thompson.
Let's say that happened. Straight up, Kyrie for Klay Thompson. Who makes who better? You follow much closer than I do. I mean, is Golden State, are they a better team if they have Kyrie than Klay?
No.
Okay, is Cleveland a better team with Klay than Kyrie?
Yes.
Well, then no wonder why they wanted to make the call.
I mean, you want to upgrade your team? Kyrie, are you going to have LeBron play the point? You can put Klay Thompson out there as a sniper along with LeBron James. You would absolutely do that. Not to mention, there's no contest when it comes to who's a better defender, Klay Thompson or Kyrie Irving. But Klay's a top three defender at his position in the NBA, and Kyrie is bottom three in the NBA at defending his position.
He's at least probably ahead of Isaiah Thomas,
yeah,
right?
So he was bottom. Isaiah's bottom one.
Yeah.
So we had two guys that, if you locked them in a room against one another, that were the principals in the trade, that neither one would stop the other one ever.
No, they trade 50-point game. They play each other in the opener. October 17th.
Maybe Kyrie, the NBA knows more than we do.
Versus Isaiah.
Maybe that's why they made that the opener.
Each of them.
Cavs, Warriors.
Those schedulers know everything, don't they?
They really
the NFL schedulers are almost always there.
You know, Saints-Vikings, your first Monday night game before Adrian Peterson ever signed with
right.
the Saints. Yeah, there's some issues now. Chris, I think the bigger issue, what happens to the NBA 2K18?
Because
Kyrie Irving's on the cover in a Cavaliers jersey. The game ships in just under a month. I believe it's September 19th. Do they recall everything that's already been sent? Do they deal with it? What do you?
This is tough. I don't know. This has never happened. Like, imagine in all the years they put somebody on the cover, they're on that team to begin that season. NBA 2K, every year they've had a cover, that dude has been on that team to begin the season. I don't know how you handle this. I don't think you can. You know how much money it takes to design the cover art and to distribute that and how many different channels it has to go through? This is a problem. We're going to have Kyrie Irving on the Cleveland Cavaliers in the cover of NBA 2K18. Maybe that's the best
cover,
representation.
But no, what if we buy the game? Who's he going to be playing for in the game?
They can update the rosters.
They've already tweeted out pictures of him in his Celtics jersey, of Isaiah in his Cavs jersey. It's just fixing the cover.
Yeah, they got to fix the cover. Now, I think it would be a best representation of the NBA to leave it, because it just goes to show you can't predict this league.
Yeah.
It's probably a symbol of the volatility of the NBA, is if your cover athlete of your game isn't even on the team that you put them on at the beginning of the year.
Is that the new 2K jinx? We have the Madden jinx guy who always gets hurt last year. Paul George, no longer on his team this year. Kyrie Irving, no longer on. So is that the new jinx?
If you're on the 2K, in some cases, maybe somebody might like it because they might rather be on a new team.
So is that what we're talking about now? Oh, they put Kevin Durant on the 2K19 cover. Does that mean he's gone in Golden State? Is that our new cover jinx we can follow now, Chris Lewis?
I think it has to be discussed. But the thing about 2K, they do weird things like put three athletes on the cover. Like, they had the Steph Curry, James Harden, and Anthony Davis all on the cover at once. I think at one point they put Michael Jordan on the cover.
Do they do anything like the college football magazines do, where they like put regional covers out? Like, if they had it in a store in the Bay Area, would you get Steph Curry? And if they had it in a store in, say, New Orleans, you get Anthony Davis?
Nah, they don't really do that. Sometimes they have like a special edition cover, like where like Madden had Vince Young on a cover once, and if you didn't want the Vince Young cover, you could buy the Brett Favre special edition.
Well, I think Xbox also, or Madden had it, was different for Xbox and PlayStation. They had separate covers.
Okay.
So that was the other big thing. And we'll end the sports update by saying, looks like there might be at least one rookie starter in the NFL. The Browns have announced that Deshaun Kizer is going to start week 3 of the preseason, and that Brock Osweiler, who started the first 2 games, not even going to make a single appearance in the game. And I believe someone on this station said a rookie would start, and it would be Deshaun Kizer. And I think that was me.
It was you.
Fish tank.
It was a fish tank.
Fruition.
Well, maybe. You know what this says to me? I don't know what it says about Deshaun Kizer, but I said, I think it says Osweiler's not good.
Well, 3 for 8 for 25 yards? Wasn't that his stats?
I think it was 6 for 8.
He did have six. Yeah, he was completing 75% of his passes.
3 for 8 at least for 25 makes 6. Oh.
8 yards a pop. You'd be mad about the completion percentage.
Yeah, 6 for 8 for 25. That's all we need to know.
Listen to the ticket on your way to and from Broncos Fan Appreciation Day at Albertson Stadium on Saturday. Mike Prater, Chris Lewis, and I will preview and review the Broncos final scrimmage. We'll be on before it from 1 to 2, and then we'll be on after it from 3:30 to 4:30, all right here on your FM home of Bronco Football, Sports Radio, 93.1 FM, The Ticket. Up next, the things we learned on today's show. It'll include something on the big NBA trade, as well as Cedric Wilson talking about the greatest catch he's ever made. You can win a table for 4 at Dave & Buster's to watch the Mayweather-McGregor fight. You can register at KTIK.com right now for you and 3 buddies to watch the fight in style, complete with appetizers and beverages. Hit KTIK.com to win a VIP table for the fight right now.
And it's time to figure out what we learned on today's show on Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris. It's sponsored by Pro-Am Sports, your full-service pro shop and bowling specialist with high-quality bowling balls, bags, shoes, and accessories. It's located right inside Westie's Garden Lanes in Garden City. We started the day talking to Cedric Wilson as he prepares for the upcoming season. But what we wanted to know about was what is now being called the catch. I'm pretty sure at this point he jumped over the Monstars, did a somersault. He was at least 35 feet in the air. He was probably blinded by the eclipse. Am I missing anything, Chris Lewis, about this catch that nobody saw?
You mentioned the Monstars. You forgot the Michael Jordan aspect where his arms stretched out from like half court.
And the game, it was the game winner. They won the national championship in a scrimmage.
Yep.
Everything else. Well, we talked to Cedric Wilson, and this is what he had to say about the legendary catch.
I think it was a pretty good catch when I watched it on film, but I think it just came from like preparation and like just working on hand-eye coordination a lot. And then my coach says, whatever you practice is going to become game reality. And it just went out there and just went up for the ball.
I thought one of the good questions you also asked in the interview was, does he know at the time it's that good a catch? And he kind of said yes, but then he said you really have to look at it again to see how good it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I always wonder. I mean, as somebody who hasn't done anything that athletic in their life, I want to know, like, do you know when you do something that's crazy, or do you got to watch it back? I know from people who've dunked on people before, they said they have to watch it back to realize how crazy it was. Because in the moment, you don't realize it. But you can see sometimes what gives it away is the reactions of the other people. And mm-hmm. you can sort of tell from the reactions of the other people when it's a crazy dunk. Like if the bench is just leaping up and down, you know, all right, I just did work.
And it's usually the people that are a little bit away from the play, the defensive people that were there that he was kind of catching the ball around, they might not have had full appreciation that somebody maybe the quarterback or one of the offensive linemen that's kind of looking down into the end zone would have.
Yeah, I want to know what the reaction was when it was played in the film room the next day or whenever they, as a team, got a chance to see it one more time. Like, did they all yell and scream once again and acted like it was the first time they saw it? You know, those are always fun moments within a team.
And I would think, too, that if this was in, let's say it was in a real game, what could you do if you're the other team? You're watching it back on film again. Let's say it was the game-winning touchdown. If somebody makes a play that's that good, you just kind of have to shake their hand, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just shake their hand. There's good defense, and then there's better offense. I was in basketball all the time. You can do all the work you can, be the best position in defense, and hit a crazy fadeaway jumper, and what can you do? Same in football. The corner can do everything right. It could be a double team. I don't know what happened on this play still. Might have been 8 guys by Cedric Wilson.
I think it was at least 15.
He jumped over all of them and made the catch.
Everyone who plays defense, scholarship, walk-on, maybe even Coach Harsin was out there playing defense. That's what it's gotten to at this point. Chris, I think you're excited, though. He did say in that answer, Coach Harsin says what you do in practice becomes reality. That's what you're hoping for, right?
Yeah. I want to see it. I want Bob to describe it and have the greatest play-by-play call of all time. Bob, meanwhile, later on in that interview said, I hope all your catches are wide open. I'm like, no, man. I want to see you make some crazy catches out there next season. I want to see some highlight reels. So, you know, give it a little balance. You need to show your separation skills of getting open and then show your ability to go over the top and make some crazy catches, and then you'll be an NFL receiver next year.
We'll speak about the highlight reel. 2 highlight reel players were traded yesterday. Kyrie Irving sent over to the Celtics in exchange for Isaiah Thomas and some other parts and a draft pick to the Cavaliers. We had Eric Pincus on from Basketball Insiders, and he said the trade was a win for both teams, and he explained how that's possible.
This is a now situation for the Cavs. After now, meaning this year, I do think LeBron leaves. And so now you have pieces that you can build around. So let's say you get Michael Porter Jr., one of the top prospects. And now it's a win now for the Cavs because they've got pieces to rebuild. For the Celtics, it's about now. But now for them is a longer now. Okay, so the now for them is like a 5-6 year window.
Okay. So it's now for both teams, but if one team was better for now than the other, then that team has to be the winner of the trade. And if you're the winner of the trade, it means the other team's a loser if now is next season. Now, I understand his point that, like, I guess Boston was doing this more for the next, let's say, 3 years, 4 years than this next season. Well, all their other moves were about this next season. Like, they brought in Gordon Hayward, selling him on the fact that you could compete right away. So then to make a trade that makes you less likely to win a championship this year, less likely to beat Cleveland, there's some shadiness to that move. I'm not a big fan of it from Danny Ainge's perspective. And now if you wanted to say, okay, let's try to build it for 3 to 4 years from now, I think there were other moves that they could have made throughout this offseason that could have better set them up for 3 or 4 years down the line while being, if not more competitive for this season in the process.
I was going to say, I would have almost thought the Celtics did it for now because they've got Irving for 2 years, mm-hmm. and they're losing a pick later.
Exactly. They gave up the most valuable future asset of the deal.
Jeff Caves in studio. Jeff, what do you guys have on tap today?
Well, we have got an MMA matchmaker, a sentinel, a soldier who guarded the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers, also a local who is never going to watch the NFL again this year. And the commissioner of the Mountain West Conference, and maybe he'll answer my question why I think college football games on Facebook's a disaster.
And there's going to be 6 or so Mountain West games that are going to be on Facebook.
Then if I'm 18 to 21, I want to be on ESPN. Anybody. We could be on Facebook right now. Mm-hmm. You want to be? Just turn over the camera. Away we go. So Facebook's not even selling ads. They're a long way away from making this all fly. I don't know if it'll catch up in time for 2019 or not, but we'll ask the commissioner that question and see what he has to say.
Fascinating. Thanks, Jeff. We look forward to it again. Craig Thompson, commissioner of the Mountain West, coming at 4 o'clock.
Seems like the Mountain West was a conference trying to take control of how they distribute their product. They're really trying to take control of, you know, give them more favorable start times, because if they want to put these things through Facebook or Twitter or Campus Insider, however they are trying to distribute their game, they're trying to put themselves where we don't have to rely on ESPN and then give us all these terrible start times for these games. And ESPN's going downhill anyway, so why do we need you? So I could see their perspective from doing this, but I also see Jeff's where, like, you know, as a kid, I want to play on TV. I don't want to play on no Facebook.
Well, I think the bigger factor, too, is money. ESPN and or television, or, you know, CBS Sports Network or Fox or whoever's in the bidding, they're giving you a check for the games. I can't believe Facebook's going to give you money, especially if they're not selling advertising.
Well, Facebook's going to pay for something. If you pay attention, the next bargaining agreement or the next time these contracts come up, they're saying Amazon's going to be a player for rights, and whether it's NFL or maybe they
but they're going to have to sell ads if that's the case.
Yeah, but, like, they want to get into the game, and they're willing to pay. They got money.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if the Mountain West is going to get any cut of that. Maybe they will. Maybe that's what Craig Thompson will tell Jeff Caves. We'll be back tomorrow. Another Boise State player. And we'll get you ready for the scrimmage coming up on Saturday as well. That's Sports Radio The Ticket. Idaho Sports Talk, Bob and Chris. Caves and Prater next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM. The Ticket.